You're listening to a download from the outdoorstation.co.uk. Number 490.
Hello and welcome back to part two of my fascinating interview with Jenny Wordsworth, who is probably better known by her maiden name, Jenny Davis. In part one, we heard about her record attempt to be the fastest woman to reach the South Pole, and how, only a few weeks in, she was medevaced out with a bowel infection and peritonitis, which ultimately saved her life. In this podcast, our conversation continues, and we hear about the preparation a trip like this involves, how her endurance racing experience affected her approach to gear, much to the consternation of traditional thoughts, and how she was involved in changing the law in Iran so that women could legally be allowed to run in a public race. I hope you enjoy listening to this interview. All the details can be found over on the outdoorstation.co.uk podcast show notes, of course. We pick up where we left off, and I wondered how far she'd actually travelled before it all went wrong.
Don't know the exact number. Probably just shy of 300, 280 or something.
Okay. Yeah.
The truth is, I was unlikely... I wasn't going to break the record anyway, I don't think. The conditions felt like they were worsening rather than, you know, improving. But I, you know, I was carrying on anyway. I knew that, and I'd spoken to my dad about it, who was expedition manager. But I wanted to work hard to be able to be there. And I wasn't about to stop just because I wasn't going to, you know, make it.
Well, I think we should also let listeners know that, obviously, from a professional point of view, you're actually a lawyer, and you—I don't know how you managed to fit in all the training, the preparation, as well as doing legal work. Because legal work, I know, takes an immense amount of life from you. But how did you, how did you find the time to prepare for this in the first place, as well as obviously do all the research for the equipment?
Oh, it's all a bit of a blur. we all know this, but you ultimately make time for the things that you love and you want to make happen. I'm the group head of legal for a renewable energy company here in the UK. We're listed on AIM, an exchange here based in London. They're called SIMEC Atlantis Energy. And I guess I'm really fortunate. The board there, the team there are very supportive of what I do. We make my absence work by getting in one or two lawyers to cover me while I'm away. But the lead up to leaving for Antarctica was incredibly tough. Fitting in all of the press obligations, the training, still doing a good job at work was really, really difficult. But I basically had no social life. That was definitely what had to go. And friends would joke that if they wanted to see me, they'd have to come out training with me and drag a tire. And a lot of people say, oh, you know, it sounds like so many sacrifices had to be made, but I've never looked at it that way. This is something I wanted to do. But it was hard. It was definitely hard.
Let's talk about equipment for a minute, because I know you're a bit of a gear geek, and the traditional winter Antarctic and Arctic equipment tends to be the same as it was probably 30 or 40 years ago in many respects. But I understand you really did get stuck into some equipment design or equipment modifications to actually get the weight down of the sled.
Yeah, so a lot of work's spent on the stove, but actually I guess that's not from a weight perspective as much as it is from a fuel efficiency perspective. But I took every single piece of kit and looked at how, and this is kit that is, you've got to, there's a balance to be struck. It's got to be kit that is tried and tested in those conditions. And so you can try and replicate that by being, you know, I did a lot of training in Norway. I'm sure it's cold there, but it's not the same conditions as Antarctica. So first and foremost, you need to know that it will work down there. Yeah, so modifications are things like taking off all the extra bits of your backpack that don't need to be there. From memory, it's funny how you remember all the weights. I think that saved me 80 grams. From the food perspective, that was quite major because I focus on very much a higher fat diet than most people would take. And that's because you get more bang for your buck calorie-wise. So if you're getting more calorie wise and the food weighs less, then you're saving a lot of weight because you're carrying 40 days. I took 40 days worth of food with me, and that gets heavy. So that the weight for that went from, I think, about a kilo a day down to 800-ish grams. So you can already see that the savings are huge. And really, I mean, take something as simple as the toilet roll you need to have out there. Finding the lightweight, like what is the most lightweight available toilet roll there is. And it's just applying that to absolutely everything you need out there. You need emergency equipment to fix things when they break. You need replacement parts of the tent in case that breaks, in case it blows away. You need bits to repair the bindings on your ski if there's any problems with that. And you know, I guess the usual weight of someone doing an expedition like this, and there isn't a huge amount to base it on, there's only been about, I think I would have been like the sixth or seventh woman to reach the South Pole. And more men have done it, I think 25, 26 overall. So it's not a huge amount of data you can look at, but mostly people's sleds would weigh about 110 to 130 kilos. And mine of the starting blocks was 72. So it makes a huge difference being able to get it down to that weight. And actually looking back, I probably could have reduced it by another 3 to 4 kilos. But that's obviously only now knowing what I know, having been through it.
Certainly a lot of our listeners will have their ideas of how they pack their bags and what gear they take for most of their expeditions or their personal challenges or trips, whatever you want to call it, really. And I'm just curious to know if you have the same formula, even in those conditions, such as most long-distance hikers, for example, will have obviously what they wear during the day and then some dry stuff for the night. They'll have a couple of extra layers of insulation. They'll have the appropriate camping equipment to ensure that they are comfortable and it's able to cope with the conditions. I understand what you're saying about the sort of spare parts and the breakages part, but would that sum up the contents of your clothes and your kit bag, or did you have multiple layers of clothing just in case one item failed?
So on the clothing side, I was very lightweight. I had one of what I needed. I think I had one spare lightweight down jacket, but that was it. I don't think you need extra clothes. Like a lot of people like having backups, or more comforts. I really had no kind of comforts at all. I had a toothbrush, which I cut in half, so it was tiny, tiny amount of toothpaste. but yeah, it was just keeping everything as absolutely lightweight as possible. In terms of sleeping, I had the Therm-a-Rest ridge rest, just the usual one you get in any camping store. And on top of that, I had an inflatable mattress, a down one, so to really insulate you from the cold, kind of got double layers going on there, and a minus 40 Western Mountaineering Bison sleeping bag. I decided, and that you could get that a little bit lighter, to be honest, but I decided sleep was so important for an expedition like this, and I was incredibly comfortable every single evening. So yeah, that's a sleeping arrangement that probably came to about 2 kilos roughly. And then the rest of your sled is made up of the fuel, the food, and they're probably the two heaviest things. And you have to calculate a daily amount of fuel to take with you, and then not use more than that, obviously. And the rest of the kit is just like you said, what a normal hiker might have in there, just really, really lightweight and no kind of modern comforts in there. I did ski with a backpack on me, which is more of a safety, and the harness was connected to the backpack dragging the sled. And inside the backpack, there would be a spare satellite phone, a spare compass, some ropes, some carabiners, and some food, and a big expedition down jacket. And that was just in case you fell in a crevasse or something happened for some reason, you lost your sled, and you'd have in there what you needed to get an emergency call in and be warm and well-fed for a few hours.
Cool, that's really interesting. Thank you for that. That's really interesting. Okay, so let's move on from obviously this expedition. It sounds like it was obviously a great experience. Unfortunately, obviously, it didn't turn out as you wished. But having said that, you're still alive, so there's a positive. that's always a good thing. And it's interesting that you actually, you know, a lot of things you're talking about, you've approached from a adventure racing point of view, ultras point of view, in the sense that you've looked at everything you take on ultra marathons, like the Marathon du Sable, etc., and applied that concept to the equipment and the way you approach this. just as a still sort of hovering on the subject, did many people raise an eyebrow when you did that? You approached it that way?
Yeah, it's funny you asked that. They definitely did. A lot of kind of polo travel experts were a little bit surprised at some of the kit choices I made or the options I went with. And I'm all about getting information from people who are more experienced than you. And in polar expeditions, nearly everyone was. but you can't help. It's important to challenge these things and to ask the whys and why have you done it that way? And because I actually think this might work. It did. Everything I took. I mean, there's next to nothing I would change in my kit or equipment. And actually, it sounds silly, but it actually made the failure in the expedition a little bit easier to deal with, that and my approach to the training, which is also a little bit different to most. But it worked really well, and so I took a lot of comfort from that. But yeah, I did have a few raised eyebrows, bringing the kind of background to ultra racing to polar expeditions.
Yes, I can imagine there was somebody with handlebars moustache saying, "We just don't do it like that."
Yeah, it's not far off, yeah.
So you touched on the training then. Just briefly, how much training did this take? I mean, are we talking 12 months, 18 months, 2 years? And is it a long, slow build-up of resistance training?
Yeah, so I guess I wasn't starting from nothing with a background in long-distance running. It's quite strength and conditioning is a big part of my training anyway, but really focusing for Antarctica was probably about 6 months out. And that was attempting to put muscle on. I had to gain a lot of weight before I went there, which was fun, actually. And it's really, really boring training, if I'm honest. It's many, many hours at low intensity, so the heart rate's fairly low. Just dragging heavy things, and you can do it in the outdoors, which I prefer to do, dragging tires on a harness, that replicates it really well because you get the drag. So it's really hard on tarmac, for example, probably the toughest conditions you can do it on. It's also great to do it on the beach, or grass is really difficult to drag your tires along. So we do that a lot. And it got to the point, actually, where even our dog, if he sees the tire now, he runs away from it. Because he remembers being taken out on 8 hours at a time to drag. But fitting in with work, I would only do the kind of really long sessions, obviously, at the weekend, get up really early. But it does mean your life and your other half life kind of all become about you and your training, and trying to fit it all in. Weightlifting is incredibly important. Putting muscle on, getting strong. For the repetitive nature of what you're doing, you know, 40 days, well, I didn't do the full 40 days, but skiing for that long and the movement is exactly the same. You want to kind of bulletproof everything on your body, so it can get you through what you're about to ask it to do.
You're listening to theoutdoorsstation.co.uk. The home of UK-based audio and video podcasts for lovers of the great outdoors everywhere.
I noticed recently on your Instagram page, you're doing squats with, or deadlift rather, with a rather interesting weight, and you're a very slight person, aren't you? You must be what, 5'4", 5'6", something like that.
I am 5'10".
Oh, I do apologise. Yeah. Tell the person to take the picture from a different angle.
Yeah, I think I was really bending down in the deadlift position, but no, I'm pretty tall.
Let's touch on the ultra marathons now. You've done the marathon, the Sable, you've done the Arctic Ultra, the Iran Silk Road, and that I'll come to that in a second, and the Cape Wrath Ultra, which is an interesting little run. But in particular, you've got a leaning towards, well, the Iran Silk Road was in particular what interested me, was it was the first time women were allowed to run with men.
Yeah, that was quite an experience. I'm an ambassador for two women in sports charities. One, Women in Sport, which focuses here in the UK, and the other one, Free to Run, which is more about women in different countries. And at the time, we were interested in taking part in this race. We'd received an invite to go out there. And then we found out that actually, I was really excited actually about meeting some local women who'd also be taking part in the race. And this would be just fascinating to learn about Iran and what it's like for them to, you know, to be a woman there. And then we were told, no, there won't be any women taking part. It's actually illegal. I didn't really sit that well. And thanks to the work of Free to Run and also another race organiser in that country, they spent a huge amount of time and work lobbying, and eventually the law was changed. So women were allowed to take part in this race alongside men. That was the first time in 38 years that I'd ever been permitted. So that was huge. But at this point, it was, I think it was only a few weeks away, maybe up to a month until the race. And then finding women who would take part with us in a team was really quite difficult. And I guess there's a little bit of suspicion that this was actually correct. You know, you might have a bit of paper that says, well, I'd take part, but are you sure? And what happens when you guys have left and that kind of thing, which is completely understandable. Mm. You have to be very delicate about doing these kinds of things. And then we met this incredible woman called Mahsa Tarabi, and she just didn't care. She was taking part in this race for women everywhere in Iran, and she couldn't wait. So I coached her using WhatsApp, which was hilarious. She was just such a lovely woman, and she'd never done any running. So obviously the race was a 6-day race, 250 kilometres through the desert. So quickly got all the kit that she would need, and I flew out with it. But training wise, it was more about just completing the race. You know, I said to her, you're just going to walk this. I don't want you to get injured, and run if you'd like, but, you know, let's just take it easy. She did it. She completed it, and she's the first Iranian woman to do so. But it was definitely the toughest event I, both of us have ever taken part in. On one of the days, I just don't know how we got through this, but temperatures reached 66 degrees Celsius. Yeah. And I actually, yeah, I don't recommend this race. I think they've now moved the time of year that takes place. But it was the first year of this event being put together as my Italian race organizer, and it just wasn't safe. The water stations, I'm sure, you know, in races, you're kind of told in these long races that the water station where they'll be. So every 10 kilometers, every 15 kilometers, and you plan accordingly. So you know how much water you have until you're going to get some more. And they kept being moved, or they weren't there. And so it was actually quite dangerous. We were running at one point with huge lumps of ice under our hats just to kind of keep the core temperature cool on the back of your neck and on your head. But it was absolutely horrific. Make no mistake. And I won that race. And then there was this just over the top crazy award ceremony. I think by this point the Iranian government had really got on board with what they were celebrating here and really wanted to put their best foot forward, and it was an amazing event. And you know, Mahsa the next day was all over the news, and she now does a lot of work in Iran. She's since set up the first Iranian women's mountaineering club, cycling club, and she is a real kind of poster girl out there for women being allowed to do these things now. And she's just amazing. Wow. It gives me goosebumps whenever I talk about her. She's so brave, and just gets on with it. Doesn't, you know, she's very respectful about what the implications might be of taking it too far, but she's incredible.
Yeah. Well, forgive my ignorance on the subject, and I'm sure a lot of people listening have this vision of somebody, a female running in Iran, would be wearing certain type of clothing. Was she allowed to wear?
So she had to be completely covered up, as you'd expect, and so did I. We were not allowed to show any skin. And I lived as a kid in Qatar for a couple of years, so I was kind of well-versed in how to dress respectfully in countries like that. But Iran was a bit of a shock, actually, because it wasn't just about being covered up. The clothing had to be loose. You had to have a headscarf on, which I hadn't done before. And it wasn't that pleasant running in that kind of heat, to be completely covered up.
Add to your heat, surely.
Yeah, it did. But, you know, I don't mind saying this. When we were away, we only went through a few towns, and it was, you know, we had to be incredibly strict then. Because, you know, this is the first time this allowed this to happen. You want to make sure it can happen again. So you're very, very respectful. But once we were out in the real desert where there just isn't anyone there, it was the Dashi Lut desert, then yeah, I rolled up my sleeves and rolled up my shorts a bit, you know, because there's no one around. So there's no harm in that. And everyone did that. That was fine. But yeah, it was really, really difficult to run like that covered up.
What a fascinating few years you've had.
Yeah.
Now, you're also an ambassador for Free to Run, and as well as Women in Sport. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
So that was all of the work out in Iran. Okay. Was with Free to Run, yeah. So they tend to focus, I think now there's more of a focus on promoting female participation in Hong Kong for the refugees out there. And then the Women in Sport one I mentioned is like the UK equivalent, if you like. So they do so much in the UK, but a lot of it is focused on changing how women are portrayed in the media and sport and expeditions such as mine. But also then trying to get more female role models in front of children, boys and girls, at a formative age. And they used to actually think that was around teenage years. But now they realise it's more important to get them 6, 7 years old is the more critical age for young boys and young girls to kind of see females in these roles.
Well, congratulations for everything you do, because I don't know how you fit it in with normal life as well. Perhaps you don't have a normal life, actually, thinking about it.
I think
you, by the sound of it, you've got the dog, and that's probably about it. Just as a sort of aside, again, a curious one from my point of view, and I'm sure many listeners as well, when it comes to getting sponsors and the administration that goes on by when you're in somebody in your position, as in somebody that's grown from endurance racing and then gained sponsors and gained not so much followers, but, you know, done this, it's the financial support I was thinking of, really. Could you just explain, is it fairly easy to obtain sponsors and support for these projects that you do and other things you're involved in, or is it a real hard sell?
I always say, actually, I don't think it's a hard sell. A lot of companies want to work with women who are doing these kind of things, maybe perhaps more so at the moment than they do men, which we should, all women out there who are thinking of doing like this, you should use to your advantage. A lot of it, it's not even to do, I don't think, with the network you might have or not have. One of my second biggest sponsor was because I was sitting at my laptop one morning. I was having breakfast, which is what I always have for breakfast, which was part of breakfast was an Atkins protein bar. And I sat there eating it and thought, do you know what? I'm just going to drop them an email and tell them I use your bars a lot. And I'm doing this thing in Antarctica and I was wondering if we could speak about it. And that was actually just a contact form on their website, and the rest is history. So it's not, you can make it happen if you want to make it happen. It is a huge amount of work. You get a lot of knockbacks, and a lot of it can be like you've just missed the boat in terms of the budget timing for that company, and they've spent their allocated the budget for that year and you're a bit too late. So it's a lot of work. And you know, I had a period of time where I had all the funds confirmed and then one of it fell through, and so it's not easy, but it definitely helps having a platform, because when you are speaking to these companies, you're trying to demonstrate to them how are they going to get their return on the investment. They're not doing this from the goodness of their hearts. They want to see something out of it too, which is business. Yeah, and understandable. Yeah. So for me, I do have a platform online, social media, and I've been in the press a fair bit, so you can point to that, which is great. And yeah, it massively helps. That I used to be quite childish about the platform thing because I didn't really enjoy having to do that side of things. But I quickly learned that actually the women's teams, I put together these annual women's running teams every year. We focus on a different country every year. You know, that has all been possible thanks to the platform that I have. And that's something that makes it a lot easier to work on. No, it is. Of course, it's a huge amount of work. It takes it took me about 2 years to put this expedition together.
What do sponsors? I mean, I would say the return on investment is the important thing. But are they sort of fairly equal in regards to what they expect from you after the event? Apart from obviously during the event, you've got the name splashed everywhere and it's on your equipment, I guess, and in the photos, etc., etc. But after the event, yeah. Do they have other further expectations of you?
They can do. I guess it depends what you've agreed with them. So my main sponsor is DHL, the logistics and delivery company, and they will have me come in and I'll do like a keynote speaking event. I'll be part of the what we've agreed, or perhaps some executive coaching internally. It really just depends. Yeah.
It's been a fascinating hour talking to you, and thank you so much for spending the time. I do have one particular question to ask you. Apart from your passion for Nando's, which I didn't touch on, of all the things I could have asked you, of all the things I could have asked you about your rich and full few years life doing these things, what should I have asked you?
Oh, gosh, that's a good question. What's next?
Well, you told me not to mention that at the very beginning before we started recording.
A really good question. I guess the one that I get asked a lot, and maybe it isn't the best thing to ask because I never have a perfect answer, but I'm still trying to think it through, is why do you do this stuff? It's actually, for me right now, I spend a lot of time, I guess I'm still processing the what I call the, you know, it's a failure, what happened out in Antarctica to me. And I'm okay with that. And I've noticed a lot of people don't really like me saying that it's a failure, which I find interesting. But to me, it's very black and white. Like, I had a goal out there and I failed in that goal. And I know there's a huge amount of successes in other ways. I, you know, actually came back and I'd gained 18% muscle mass, which is just unheard of. And like I said about the kit and the training, all that made me feel better. But I definitely had a period when I got back where I wondered if I should be this kind of person anymore. And part of that is to do with it was such a public failure. It was all over the press. And they used, like, they found one photo of me looking a bit sad from somewhere. And the headline was like, lawyer fails at world record attempt or something. But actually what I'm starting to realize now is that if you're going to do these kind of things, it's going to be in the press. Like, there's probably a higher chance of you not achieving the goal because you're doing things that are quite difficult. So more important for me and for whatever comes next is actually learning. And it's not that easy, but it's learning to kind of get comfortable with the fact that you might fail again. Because no one wants to keep not achieving goals that they publicly set out to do. But yeah, getting more comfortable with failure is probably quite key for me going forward.
It's hard to associate everything Jenny has been through as a failure, but I guess we are all our own worst critics. My thanks go to Jenny, of course, for taking the time to talk to me and for sharing her honest thoughts on the Antarctic attempt and also her involvement with the Women in Sport charities. The fact that she's able to do all this, train, plan, prepare, deal with her social media, handle sponsors and hold down what I expect to be a demanding job, is an inspiration in itself. If you want to find out more about Jenny, her wealth of endurance experience, please check out the podcast show notes over on theoutdoorstation.co.uk. Until next time, folks, take care out there and bye for now.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To hear or see more from our extensive free library, please visit theoutdoorstation.co.uk.